Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, and joining me today is...
Corey the Jaws Knockreiner.
All right, anyways, on today's episode, we're going to chat about an update on the Magecart payment card skimming malware out of RiskIQ, an update on one of our favorite whistleblowers slash traders, and an analysis done by Cybereason through the entire exploit chain of a new Python-based remote access Trojan. So with that, let's go ahead and slide on in.
Whoa, that's new. I don't think I heard slide. Maybe I have, because I feel like I've done the electric slide joke before. So maybe Probably. You've said slide before.
So back in quarter four of 2019 in our internet security report, we covered the Magecart payment card skimming malware that infected Macy's website, as well as a few other websites like British Airways back the year prior. In that report, if you read it, we got a few samples, including the really specialized one that targeted British Airways, but then also some more generic catch-all versions of Magecart. And the reason we picked that as our top security incident was because for the past few years prior to that, and now even after it, Magecart infections have seemingly been on the rise. And just last week, researchers at RiskIQ published their own report where they were actually able to track a specific kit for Magecart called the InterSkimmer, as used by several Magecart threat actors. And in the report, they were actually able to track the kit's development. They linked it to a single threat actor that was known as Sochi, who also previously went by Poder, interesting name, on a few different dark web marketplaces.
Potter minus a T.
Yeah, exactly. The report, it was pretty thorough. There were some really interesting bits out of it that I wanted to chat about. So the first being that previously researchers at Recorded Future originally found that this Poder individual and Sochi were different threat actors because they were operating at different times. But RiskIQ was actually able to link them together with a few different bits of supporting evidence. First off, they found both of the exploit kits, so the one originally developed by Poder and then this new InterSkimmer one developed by Sochi, were hosted on the same domain. They were able to point to a few weeks, actually, in January of 2019, where Poder seemed to take down their old kit and then transition to the new one along with their new alter ego as well. They had a few other supporting pieces of supporting evidence, like the Whois information for a lot of the shared domains between the two were registered at the same email address and phone numbers, which actually come to think of it is interesting
if you think about it. I was going to say there's a lot of what do they call it? Domain privacy services now that make it able, you know, they're sold to normal, legit businesses, but Whois, as I'm sure everyone knows, when you register a domain name, you kind of legally, according to the folks that, you know, take care of domain names, you have to share, like, the administrator of the domain, an email address, a phone number, some identifying information. But there are services now that kind of anonymize that. So what might be in the Whois record may not directly be a person. It may be a service. Now, you still have to, that service has to eventually share who the person is in certain cases. But I'm surprised that these guys didn't use some sort of anonymizing service, because I believe they've been available for, you know, years and years.
Even like GDPR has some provisions for protecting information and allowing European citizens to provide less information for these Whois lookups. It wasn't clear in the report if the shared information was legitimate or if it was just a fake persona from another country. I think they were both, like, their addresses were based in France. But regardless, it was at least the same info.
Which does not seem like... Yeah, and by the way, if you look at the posts on this, which maybe you're getting to, it's a lot of Russian-speaking posts, so yeah. There's a good chance that France isn't really where they're from.
Yeah, so basically sometime around January of 2019, the individual behind this switched from their old kit to their new one. Their old kit actually had a different licensing model entirely. It was $5,000 to get a license for this. So it's basically malware as a service at this point. You gain access to their command and control infrastructure. You still have to, you're still responsible for distributing it. So infecting websites and injecting this malicious JavaScript into them. But $5,000 gets you the malware. The updated kit, though, changed that to a just $1,500 licensing fee or a 30-70% profit split if you didn't want to pay any money up front. And Risk IQ actually surmised that like this change of model, the reduce in price and the option of no front-facing price might have led to quite a bit of the like rapid spread of this type of malware over the past 2 years. The latest version of InterSkimmer actually has a few new features on it too. Like it has deduplication protection where it'll take MD5 hashes of stolen data and compare it to previously skimmed data and then remove the duplicates. It can even generate fake payment forms for websites that use payment providers like PayPal and inject those into there too. So a lot of interesting new features that it's been advertising as well. And like from their article, they mentioned they were able to identify 1,500 sites or over 1,500 sites that had been infected by this specific kit, which is a pretty substantial number.
Yeah, and it's been around for years. Even back in mid last year, over 1,000 sites or right around 1,000 sites, I think maybe 960 some had already been infected by some variant of Magecart. So it's definitely one of the top skimmers right now. I think maybe chip and pin plus a combination of banking efforts and stuff probably makes the, you know, it used to be these guys would try to steal the actual magnetic stripe data on your card and clone your card. But I think it's harder to do that now. So I think this sort of skimming is kind of the alternate path.
Yeah, I mean, it's still just as easy to steal the magnetic data. It's just more difficult to use it now because so many places require chip and pin. And if you're sitting there with a fake printed card over and over, they're going to identify it pretty dang quickly. But these skimmers do seem to be much more popular. Like they have the ability, like we mentioned in the report that we put out last year, they have the ability to steal not just the payment card like number and expiration dates, but they'll grab your billing info too, basically everything they need in order to process a transaction, because these skimmers get injected on the checkout page for infected websites. Makes them really good at what they do. So, like, I guess, how do you protect against this?
Yeah, I mean, they're literally grabbing what the website is asking you to provide in order to make a payment to the site. So they don't need your card. They don't need the magnetic track data. They have the information that you're literally giving some company to make a payment at the time.
Yep, and there's a few different ways that they can infect websites with this. Like, as we noted in our report, they can find a cross-site scripting vulnerability in it, inject their code that way. Sometimes they can get into the source itself. So if the developers don't secure their whatever their code repository is or how they deliver JavaScript to their page, like in an AWS S3 bucket, for example, the threat actor might be able to replace that JavaScript or inject this code into it and then deliver it that way. And it makes it pretty difficult to detect unless you're using tools that can scan for and identify malicious JavaScript. Which luckily there are plenty out there now. Like if you're a WatchGuard customer, for example, APT Blocker is able to identify malicious JavaScript.
By the way, couldn't they, like we talk about cross-site scripting, there's the stored cross-site scripting, which is a flaw on your e-commerce. Well, both cross-site scriptings are a flaw on your e-commerce site, but sometimes they might be taking advantage of something directly on your site to put code on it. Another option is just URI parameters where it's still due to a flaw on the payment site, whatever e-commerce site you're using, but the attack isn't coming from the site so much as they have to get you, the victim, making a payment to click on a link that has additional URI parameters that helps them inject this type of JavaScript. So it in some cases, the site's infected and it's kind of totally hijacked, and anyone that goes there is an issue. In some cases, you know, they would have to target individual users to click something, even though ultimately the site's the issue still.
And the good news is, I guess if you're a a would-be victim is that stuff like Magecart is receiving a lot of attention now, which means defensive tools are focusing their efforts on trying to protect you from them. And so long as you use things that can, for example, inspect HTTPS connections and identify this JavaScript, you're in a pretty good place to be protected from this style of threat. That does point out, though, that you do need to be inspecting encrypted web traffic through your office network, or you run the risk of missing this, because if you can't see what's being loaded on a page, you can't protect against what's loaded on the page, at least at the network perimeter. So moving on to our next threat, or our next story, rather. I guess it could be a threat depending on where you stand in the intelligence community. Back in 2014, Corey's going to go on a rant during this. This is going to be very entertaining.
No, I won't.
So back in 2014, former NSA contractor Edward Snowden infamously leaked the existence of several spying programs used by the United States intelligence agency, the NSA. One of those programs was one called Mystic, in which the NSA collected metadata and, in some cases, the entire contents of phone calls from several countries, including the United States. So Snowden was obviously eventually exiled to Russia after having his passport revoked and at risk of facing prosecution back in the United States. But this story comes back with an update just last week where the U.S. Federal Appeals Court just ruled that the Mystic program and its broad surveillance granted by the secret FISA courts was in fact illegal and potentially unconstitutional. So U.S. officials and their arguments against this lawsuit that was brought on by the ACLU insisted that four cases that they've successfully convicted from individuals that were allegedly planning to pay money to terrorists were convicted in 2013 thanks to the NSA's telephone recording spying. But this court ruled on Wednesday that those claims were, quote, inconsistent with the contents of the classified report, which, incidentally enough, because the spying program had no real impact on those convictions, it also means that this ruling didn't actually taint the evidence of those trials. Normally, if, like, you know, you go to trial and it finds out the evidence was gathered illegally, you generally get a retrial. But in this case, they were basically saying it had nothing to do with it. The FBI was lying about that. This thing is just flat out. Unconstitutional.
So two sides. I mean, one, if you do think these four actors are actually criminals, it means that they are still criminals, right? They're still in jail, and this doesn't get them off stock free because this evidence had nothing to really do with their arrest. On the flip side, and a lot of times that we've been talking about Snowden, and you know, people that listen know that I believe in the intelligence agencies, I did think there's some overreach in some cases. And while I don't know if I'd call Snowden a hero, I actually honestly believe he was doing something he thought was right. But anyways, the issue I sometimes have is to defend these things. The intelligence agency often says, well, this is catching terrorists. This is what's doing it. And without this, we would be blind. And when we say, give us examples, they're like, well, we can't. This was the only example they kind of gave us, this particular case against Molin. And essentially, besides learning that this panel in the Ninth Appeals Court thinks that this is potentially unconstitutional and illegal, they literally said that this isn't what led to the arrests of the terrorist suspects. So it's just hard to take the, you know, I do want to side with the intelligence agencies. In fact, I might even have issues with certain current administrations not paying enough attention to some of what they do legally. But in this case, besides the vindication of the metadata being an overreach of private American citizens, they can't even show us proof that what they're doing is really helping, in my opinion.
Yeah. And so the reason that this was considered an overreach was because the secret FISA court, so FISA being the, Federal Intelligence Something Act, Secrecy Act, I think. I don't know. It's basically a court that is not public. It is entirely secret, where U.S. intelligence sources and law enforcement can go and request warrants to then spy on people, basically. Which makes sense. In general, if you're about to spy on someone, you don't want a public court record saying you're about to spy on them. But it does leave it open to abuse like this, basically, where they were granted a warrant or at least permission by the court to basically take all of the records from, I think Verizon was one organization, but many other phone companies and phone calls as well that included American citizens too, which is in violation of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, basically. Interestingly, though, so
well,
this
essentially they were gathering data on all American, you know, you typically do a FISA court, you know, warrant asking to do it on four individuals. But it turns out they were collecting all the data for all Americans all the time. And it's more the asking is, can we now use this thing that we already have?
Interestingly, though, this appeals court, they didn't actually rule on the constitutionality, if that's a word. Of this issue, because it didn't have any impact on that case. If it had an impact on it, they probably would have had to make a rule on whether it was unconstitutional or just illegal. So this isn't the end of this discussion, I don't think. Even though this particular program, PRISM, was shut down in 2015, it was replaced by other programs, allegedly. We will probably never know unless there's another leak. But you have to imagine this isn't the end.
To be very specific, it's not, you know, ACLU and people that like privacy think this is a win, but it's definitely not over. This was, as you've pointed out, the appeals court in the Ninth Circuit, but it was a panel of three. So the people, you know, the defendants could still appeal to an en banc court, which essentially means, hey, you only heard this with the panel of three. We want all 11 judges on this particular appeal court, or they could bring it to the Supreme Court. So while this is a win, you know, we have checks and balances in our judicial system too, so this could keep going up top.
Yeah. Then one other thing that came out of this ruling, though, is the judge also ruled that government prosecutors must tell criminal defendants when they plan to use evidence gathered or derived from surveillance done overseas, which is a pretty drastic change from what was the norm. You didn't used to have to let them know when they were going to use that evidence. That could, I mean, from the intelligence side, that could impact their ability to use it, because obviously anytime you share information you got from basically spying, you risk giving up how you got that information too. So it does open a whole nother can of worms for them as well. Like you said, though, this was a three-judge panel from the appeals court, and there's even in this court case, there's no way this is the end of it. So my question to you is, does this mean that Snowden gets to come home?
No. I think he's probably watching this election closely, but right now is probably not the time, no matter what court cases are won. I you know, who knows when Snowden will come home, but I think if you look back in our history of whistleblowers, while there are some whistleblowers that never really, you know, that maybe they didn't do the right thing, there's some that simply are considered whistleblowers that the intelligence agencies hate for 10, 15 years. But over time, 15 years later, suddenly they turn into heroes. So because they are vindicated in these sorts of situations. So I think this is one step towards maybe that process we'll continue to see. But to me, this is evidence that, you know, there's more to this story. I do really appreciate the intelligence agencies. I'm curious what some of our friends like Ricardo, you might have heard him. He used to work at a three-letter agency. One of our podcasts, him and I debated this. And you can really kind of understand why they believe strongly about the potential traitors in intelligence agencies. You know, the one thing that's definitely true is there's real human lives out there in many dangerous places. And I'm sure they take protecting those Americans very seriously, as do we all. So, you know, sharing this type of sensitive information with the world, leaking it like Snowden did, I can see why people that work in that very dangerous industry, especially the field agents, you know, you'd want to protect them. But in this case, you know, I hope that one day Snowden can come back. And even if he's found criminal for some stuff, you know, maybe it's not as bad as it would have been without this type of ruling. But I do think, you know, no matter whether you think he's a hero or a traitor, he started a conversation, and we're finding out there was overreach, or at least this appeals court says there was overreach. So, you know, he started what I think is a good thing. You can't identify whether or not there's proper checks and balances and overreach unless this happened in the first place.
And I'm not saying I agree with it or not, but one of the arguments is that, yes, what he did was potentially good because it exposed overreach by the government, but the way he did it was what was, risky or inappropriate, basically taking 1.5
or even
million
illegal
documents, and handing it over to journalists. So I can
but
see
I would
it
suggest that there's, I could see it both ways too, but that what you're referring to is the proper, there are whistleblower laws. There are supposed to be procedures and policies of doing this. But unfortunately, if you have organization that's overreaching in certain ways and lying about it, I mean, we were told straight up by the leaders of the intelligence agencies that they weren't collecting this data until it was proven that they were. So it's, I could also see the argument of how do you trust those whistleblower laws when people, when you do the right thing, it never goes to the top. And I believe if you look into the Snowden story, he at least claims he asked people about this using the proper channels at first.
And my cynicism tells me that even though we've been told this particular program has been closed down, I guarantee that the exact same thing has been spun up in some other way, and they're just a little bit better at hiding it now.
Well, we're literally talking about them trying to backdoor encryption. I mean, the leaders, even today, want the ability to subpoena any data anywhere by having a key for encryption for everything we use, even with civilian applications, Apple, Microsoft, and everything. So they're still looking for some sort of capability to have this level of mass surveillance. And, it's a gray line. I can understand the need to be able to find criminals, but I think some of what they were doing was the wrong way.
Yeah. Like it seems to be, like, drawing that line also with the backdoor encryption, it basically boils down to, yes, technically it could and probably would help, but at what cost? So, like, yes, you could potentially catch criminals and terrorists by surveilling every single citizen of the United States, but then you are also impacting the privacy of every single citizen.
Then you live in 1984. Then you're literally living in a dystopia where everyone is surveilled. And on top of that, the true criminals will know they're surveilled and will use alternate means.
Yeah, that's the encryption argument where, yes, you could potentially backdoor encryption in United States products and products that they have jurisdiction over, but then the actual criminals will
time to use Russian
else.
Ghost.
Exactly.
And whoa, suddenly e-commerce goes to Russia because they have the only working encryption.
That said, I mean, who knows if they backdoored that or not? Isn't that like a requirement for a lot of their services over there?
I have no clue. It's the first one I could think of. There are others. But yes, I bet you the FSB has something in Ghost or Ghost, however you pronounce it without the H.
Yep. But either way, Snowden is still stuck over in Russia. He still does have, I think it's 2 counts against him under the Espionage Act and also a count for stealing government property. Even though this one specific project is currently ruled illegal, that doesn't mean that the rest of his are as well, and he has really a chance of coming back scot-free.
By the way, to end on one, note, he has responded. He did a tweet yesterday. It said, 7 years ago, as the news declared I was being charged as a criminal for speaking the truth, I never imagined that I would live to see our courts condemn the NSA's activities as unlawful and in the same ruling credit me for exposing them.
Good.
And yet that day has arrived.
Good on him. I hope that, at least in this one, it sticks. We'll see, though. So moving on, researchers at CyberReason recently published their analysis of a new Python-based remote access Trojan that was developed by a threat actor known as EvilNum. That's evil and then N-U-M. I'm assuming it was like something in the code that gave them, I don't know. That's whatever.
We may not mention this, but the research you're talking about talks about related, how this group uses another group's tools and the other group is Golden Chicken. So I'm sorry, I just get a giggle when I hear about these really big threat actors, EvilNum and Golden Chicken.
It's just ridiculous. Whatever. Let's talk about the actual story.
Maybe it's in the code. It's probably in the code.
So in their report, they actually went through the entire infection process that this new remote access Trojan uses. And I wanted to talk about it because it's pretty interesting how it goes through it. So it starts with a phish, as do its seemingly most cyber attacks these days. And the phish includes a zip attachment. Inside that zip archive, if you de-archive it,
Still not unusual, right?
Yep. It just pops out
zip attachments are quite unusual.
Exactly. It's still
usual.
It pops out a link file, so .lnk extension, which are supposed to be like shortcuts.
That's where it starts to get a little less common, although do know some of the zero day that Stuxnet used before used shortcuts. Back in the old day of lots of email viruses, link files were common along with PIF files. But I'd say nowadays, link files are slightly less common to see in malware, even though they obviously, as we'll learn, still work.
Yeah, to give it a legitimate use, like let's say World of Warcraft is installed in C program files, World of Warcraft, you might have a shortcut on your desktop. It's actually a link file where if you click that, it then goes and executes the actual executable in your program files directory. In this case, though, the shortcut in the link file opened up command prompts, so command.exe, with arguments that enabled it to write other files by basically outputting specific lines from the argument string to a file in a different location. So
I was also going to say in some previous versions of this too, I think that what the user sees in the zip file doesn't look like a link file. It looks like in previous versions, it looked like an image, like a JPEG image. And as we'll get to in this version, it looks like a PDF. And we'll get to what it does later, but realize the original thing is a link file, but it also doesn't, you know, it's not making that obvious in the zip archive. It's using tricks.
It uses an icon image of a PDF, and then the file name itself looks like it ends in .pdf. So it looks like a PDF, which, like, a PDF isn't exactly benign when it comes to receiving it as an email attachment.
Oh, not at all. But even a JPEG isn't, by the way, although JPEGs are probably a little more traditionally benign than PDFs. JPEGs can be weaponized as well if you have the right vulnerability.
Either way, though, once you click this link file, though, it outputs a JavaScript file and then copies itself to a temp directory and then replaces the archived version of this link file, the one that you de-archive from the zip, with a PDF. So basically, once you click it the first time, it gets replaced with an actual PDF to make it a little harder to discover. But during that process, it rewrites itself elsewhere and outputs this JavaScript file. It then, the JavaScript file executes and it pulls a actual executable binary called ddpp.exe. That's a fun little rhyme. Out of the original link file, and then saves it to a folder called Media Player. To back up to where we're at right now, zip file, de-archive it to a link file, click that, it outputs a JavaScript and copies itself, and then replaces its original version of itself. The JavaScript then goes and downloads an executable, or pulls the executable out of that link file, and saves it in this one directory called Media Player.
DDP and also another executable name it uses is actually there's a legit file for that file. It's one of them. This is in media because it's calling itself Dolby Selector Task. And I believe in the DDP case, it's actually there's a legitimate Oracle file name. It has nothing to do with Dolby Digital. It actually is the Java. It's the normal Java web start launcher, but most of the code in this file actually is that legitimate Java web start launcher, except the legitimate one's signed, this one's not signed, and of course it has additional Trojanized stuff in the code.
So while a lot of malware gains persistence by using the Windows registry, in this case, the executable it writes, it schedules a task in the task manager that it calls Dolby Selector Task. And like you said, that ddpp.exe reuses a whole lot of code from Java Web Start Launcher, but it also has this malicious shell script injected into it as well. So now when that ddpp.exe executes from that scheduled task, it goes out to the internet and grabs another dropper file called fplayer.exe and then schedules a task to run that called adobe update.task. And this fplayer binary reuses a lot of code from an NVIDIA application called Stereoscopic 3D Driver Installer, but it still has malicious shell script injected in it as well. So let's pause right here. We've now mentioned two of the dropper executables. They're basically other applications that the malware author has injected their own shell script into. So they're using other code, I'm assuming, to try and like hit whitelists or benign lists or just get evade AV detection.
It's definitely to evade, and it's probably somewhat effective, but I can't see it being super effective in that, one, code signing is something a lot of anti-malware programs, they don't use it alone, because obviously stolen digital signatures are one way malware kind of fight this technique. But code signing is something that heuristic systems of malware do use as an indicator. So the whitelist is going to have the real hash for many of these common legitimate files, which won't match, and they'll also be expecting certain things, like things from Microsoft or Adobe or Oracle, to be signed properly. So this, what's interesting about this overall, like you say, is it's definitely evasion techniques. There are more legacy malware detection, you know, technologies and methods that might miss this. But I do think that there's some things that more modern systems would be able to catch here.
Yep. So as of right now, we're just on droppers. So the first one that got pulled out of the link file, and then the one that one went and grabbed from the internet. So this fplayer executable, then when it executes, it goes and grabs another encrypted payload from the internet and saves it in a temp directory. And then it decrypts that executable, which is the actual Python-based remote access Trojan that was compiled using py2exe, which is a pretty common program for taking a Python script and compiling it into a Windows executable binary.
Basically, it's just compiling the Python with a Python interpreter.
Yep.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
So that you don't have to have your own.
So this is like a bit of a flavor of fileless malware, and that, like, so it downloads an encrypted file onto the hard drive, which is difficult to scan and detect for malicious code, obviously, because it's encrypted. But then it loads that into memory, decrypts it in memory, maps it into memory, and then executes it in memory. So the actual decrypted Trojan is never written to disk. You only have the droppers so far, and then that encrypted blob. Which is a pretty good way of evading some traditional anti-malware engines.
Yeah, very fileless, living off the land.
Yep. That remote access Trojan that was compiled actually has its own layers of obfuscation as well. So the first layer of that malware has embedded inside itself basically an encrypted binary string, which it then decodes. And that contains the main remote access Trojan and a bunch of imported libraries to carry out its different functionality. And some of the stuff we can do, keyloggers, running command prompt commands, screenshots, downloading more Python scripts for additional functionality, can drop and upload.
Essentially rat botnet 101, all the normal things you'd expect a botnet, Trojan, or rat to do.
Exactly. And it does use encryption for communicating with the command and control server, RC4, which is also pretty common in remote access Trojan CNCs.
By the way, this one would be a little harder. We often talk about botnets or Trojans starting to use HTTPS because it's off the shelf and easy, but this is specifically not HTTPS. In fact, I think it's using the HTTP post, a non-secured HTTP post, but its actual application data is this RC4 encrypted data. So things like HTTPS inspection would not catch this. You could probably, I mean, botnet command and control, if we know the IPs that this particular command and control channel used, we could definitely catch it because it's not even encrypted. But as far as what's seen in these HTTP requests, couldn't do that in the same way you could do typical HTTPS botnets or malware that uses HTTPS command and control channels.
Yep. There are like a few other random interesting things, like one of the droppers would fingerprint any antivirus engines that were installed on the computer, which is kind of interesting. The rat itself can also fingerprint AV products that are installed, as well as like USB devices that are connected and the version of Chrome that you're running, and send them off to the attacker. all of which are very useful information if you're trying to evade and figure out how to exploit different processes.
I'd argue not that unusual, though.
Right, exactly. But it was really cool seeing basically the entire exploit flow from the phish email to depositing this rat on a computer that Cyber Reason was
able to put together. Even more, I mean, Cyber Reasons, if you read their blog post, it's extensive. Like, we just talked about the C2 channel, but then after what everything Mark just shared, they go on to actually enumerate the C2 server infrastructure too, and then expand out that infrastructure using techniques. So it was really great analysis by Cyber Reason on, I would say, one of the most full analyses of this entire kind of attack and cyber
is it
kill chain.
Analysis or analysis sci?
I think maybe in UK they legitimately call maths. So maybe analysis is the UK way of saying it.
There we go.
I'm sure I'll get some hate tweets from my friends over the pod. It's analysis. I was misspeaking. You know me and my bestest words.
The best words. The good news is if you're a WatchGuard customer, so all the malware domains, like the command and control domains it uses right now, are all, it doesn't have a domain name generation algorithm. It's all manually controlled, and there's only a few of them. They've all been added to DNS Watch. So if you're using the DNS Watch service, you are, as of right now, protected if you manage to get infected by this. But still, either way, cool write-up from Cyber Reason. I'll make sure to add a link in the show notes, because like you said, we basically talked about 10% of
it. Yeah, and some other little notes that I found. Like, one is a new tool I didn't know about, but I think I'll be looking into. A lot of our internet security reports talk about credential stealers. You know, Mimikatz is the most common. Recently, we talked about the Windows credential. What's it called?
Editor.
Yeah. But one of the things this downloads or has a module for is something called Lasagna or Lasagna with a Z, which, by the way, you can go to GitHub and grab. This is another type of credential stealing tool. So I hadn't heard of Lasagna yet. How do you say lasagna with a Z properly? Adding the Z makes me want to pronounce the G and E. Anyways. However you pronounce it, interesting new credential editor that might have been around for a while, but I didn't know about. Another little thing that for the super nerds there that are trying to learn more about malware techniques, you know, we might have referenced it before. I don't think we've talked about it in full, but MITRE has something they call the attack framework, and that's attack with a ampersand for the second A. And it basically just lists from beginning to end every single, you know, it's kind of like a deeper version of malware kill chain. It will list every capability known of how different types of malware can work. And one of the things I appreciated at the bottom of this was Cyber Reason kind of mapped the entire breakdown of this malware from initial access, execution, its persistence. Like MITRE's attack framework has different ways of doing persistence that are known by malware researchers, because there's tons of different ways to be persistent. As you mentioned, it's not always registry. There's literally tens and tens of ways. But this actually, I like the way they break it down and show you at the bottom, here's exactly what this particular, you know, piece of malware, the Peevil Rat, does.
Yep. So cool work by Cyber Reason. I guess be on the lookout for zip archives that decompress into something that looks like a PDF or an image. I would go so far as to say maybe be careful about attachments that you receive from unsolicited emails. Probably good advice just in general.
Even from people you know, if it's unsolicited and you get a random zip, ask them about it.
Exactly. Who knew that so much damage could be caused by just a fish?
Who was the captain of the Jaws boat? I'm sure he knew. I know. A shark's not technically a fish, probably.
Boo. Hey, everyone. Thanks again for listening. As always, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on the Twitterverse. I'm at @XORRO_. Corey is at @SecAdept. And the both of us are at #The443Podcast. Thanks again for listening, and you will hear from us next week.
Have a good long weekend.
Okay, bye.